Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. The government shutdown is over and the Congress has passed debt extension legislation. For now, calamity averted. Paul, what was the shutdown like in Alaska?
Well, defense people were on the job. The national security people were on the job. Parks people were sent home. We paid later. A lot of federal workers went home. It's like 700 and something parks employees, all but 50 or 20, something like that, went home. Red crab season was delayed. If you wanted to go into a national park or a national preserve, you may have a problem.
I presume that if you wanted to call the IRS.
The IRS was on the job. I'm very proud of them.
I thought that wasn't the case. No, they were?
Well, I thought they were. Yeah, I thought most of them are still there. God bless them, is what I say. For God's sake, don't audit me. The federal government, it was noticeable up here, but I think what probably was more important was, as this went on, this was going to start rippling out into the economy.
Right.
And I think people who aren't getting paid, aren't spending money, businesses aren't taking in money, so now they're waiting to be paid. Of course, they'll be paid at some point, but even now, I suspect that if you look hard enough in the economy, you can see dents and bruises and scrapes from this thing.
Okay. Steve, let's talk about the politics for the Alaska delegation in Congress. What were the consequences for our lawmakers in D.C.?
I think in the long term, I don't think there really were any consequences for them politically up here. They all seemed to say the right things. They were certainly disgusted what was going on and the lack of progress and the talks to get the government going again. Senators Murkowski and Begich, they were in favor of the final proposal, voted in favor of that. Don Young, our lone representative in Congress, he had voted against some of the earlier proposals to open the government. He found fault with them. But in the end, he was one of 87 Republicans in the House of Representatives that voted in favor of the Senate bill.
Steve, don't you think it was smart for him to vote with the Speaker? For a variety of reasons.
For what? Well, yeah, and he has told me that he supports what the Speaker stands for. He supports Speaker Boehner, and for the most part, there certainly are some differences of opinion over a few things, that's for sure. But I think for the most part, he supports what Speaker Boehner was trying to do. And yes, it was a smart thing for him to vote in favor of that final solution. And the hazard here is that this could happen again. There's a deadline looming again just a few months down the road, unbelievable as it sounds. And if things go to gridlock, who's to say this doesn't repeat itself? Maybe a couple more times before Election Day next August when we have a primary, or next November when we have the general election. So the damage is still out there. I mean, there's still a possibility of people finally just getting so angry and saying, let's just throw all the bombs, including ours, out.
Here's one thing I wondered about. Mark Begich voted the same way as Don Young and Lisa Murkowski, and this seems to me a real negative news for the Republicans who are running for the U.S. Senate, because they're always looking to differentiate him and try and find a wedge, and they'd lost a couple of months here and there's no wedge.
There is no wedge. You know, if you put Mark Begich in Montana, or if you put him in Wyoming or even in Texas, and you said, okay, well, here's his voting record and this is what he stands by, you know, he's pro-guns, he says he's smaller government, things like that, they'd call him a Republican. And I maintain that the guy he replaced, Senator Ted Stevens, if you put their records side by side, they'd be almost identical. Both are pro-choice, both pro-guns.
Pro-defense,
pro-earmarks for Alaska, pro-spending in Alaska. Good earmarks. Well, those are bad earmarks in Lower 48. The good ones are in Alaska. But if he could have scored a couple of billion dollars like Kentucky did in this deal, he'd have done it, I'm sure. Okay. But yeah, there is no wedge. There really isn't.
Let's stick with politics. Sure. Former Attorney General Dan Sullivan announces for the United States Senate. Steve, tell us about Sullivan, and what does his entry do for the dynamics of the Republican race?
He's got a pretty impressive resume. First of all, he's the former Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources for the state of Alaska, and that's the job that he resigned from in order to run for the U.S. Senate. Before that, he was the Attorney General under Governor Parnell. He's also got a 20-year career in the U.S. Marines. He's an officer. So he's got an impressive resume. What he does to the race, now he's the third major Republican candidate that has entered the race. Meade Treadwell, of course, has been running for the last 4 years, even though he's not really declared that, but he declared in June that he's running. And he's raised about $340,000 since announcing that he was running. Joe Miller is the other candidate. We saw Joe Miller a few years ago against Lisa Murkowski. He's basically the Tea Party candidate. It's going to be an interesting three-way race come August. And who knows, maybe there'll be a couple more candidates who jump into the fray. It's obvious that the Democrats perhaps fear Sullivan the most, or perhaps they want to see Treadwell or Miller be the opponent in November more so than Sullivan. But he barely finished giving his announcement that he was running when the Democrats started sending out news releases, and they ripped him for supporting House Bill 21, the income tax overhaul for the oil industry. They ripped him as being the Washington establishment handpicked.
Well, the Republicans
candidate.
Ripped him too. They said he's a newcomer, greenhorn, synthetic Alaskan, a variety of terms.
Well, one of the issues that's going to certainly come up, Democrats claim that he listed his home in Maryland as his primary residence. So they're asking the question, well, where do you live? Do you live in Maryland? You live in Alaska?
And these kind of questions are not going to go away.
No, and he refused to answer them. He brushed them off at his announcement the other day. So, and he said there's going to be time to answer these questions later on. There will
Hopefully
be
you won't ask them again.
Yes, all right. Maybe you'll forget that. But it'll be interesting.
Let's get Paul in here. Does the developments that Steve so adequately and well described mean anything for Mark Begich?
Well, it means many hours over the next month of him making voodoo dolls to stick pins into for Treadwell and Sullivan, because I think really who he wants is Joe Miller, who has a bronze star, to be his Republican adversary.
And a beard.
Absolutely. You know, some people should, some people shouldn't.
You're a should.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. What it means is that the Republicans are going to have between now and next August to pound each other to smithereens. Mm-hmm. Begich won't have to do much. Any kind of dirt on any of these three or anybody else who steps up mm-hmm. is going to be well known by then. It also means that a lot of the money that's coming into this state mm-hmm. is going to be spent trying to fight it out in this primary. Begich doesn't have a primary opponent, so his money will all be intact when the time comes. This should make an easier race in the long haul, I think, for Begich. But it'll make in the end, whoever comes out of this Republican fracas is going to be a very strong Republican
candidate. And they
candidate.
Won't have to worry about money because they'll get national
money
financing.
Money is going to flow in here by the trainload. So it's going to be an amazing race.
Steve, thinking about Sullivan, who just entered the race, what would be a roadmap or the roadmap to victory for him?
Through August.
This primary, yeah.
I think he needs to prove that he's got more experience in government than Meade Treadwell and Joe Miller. He was the head attorney for the state of Alaska for a couple of years. He was the head of the Department of Natural Resources. He knows the military because he's been in the Marine Corps. So he's got to tout those life experiences, his experience in government, and that could win the day for him.
I'm thinking that telling Republican voters those things and proving them in their heads would be, now that you know this, you know I'm the person who can beat Mark Begich. Isn't that what you'd be doing here?
I think so, too. I think each one of these candidates has to prove that they can do that. Now, Joe Miller's got some baggage, obviously. I think Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich are cut from the same cloth, and Joe Miller wasn't able to win that race. So he's really got to do a sales job with his supporters to say, I'm the one who can beat Begich in November. Treadwell, same way. Meade Treadwell has been running for some statewide office since he took the lieutenant governor's job. And a lot of people will say, that's not really experience, you know, but Meade also has a lot of resource development experience, too, in his resume. He's a pretty smart guy. But I think also the key in this is that they got to make sure that they don't beat the heck out of each other to the point where there's nothing left come November and Begich just pounds of daylights out of them, whatever daylights are left in them after that.
Once again, primary. I'm Michael Carey, and I'm here with Paul Jenkins and Steve McDonald. Paul, on the Democratic side, Native leader Byron Mallott enters the race for governor. Who is Mallott, and what can we expect from him?
He's a very smart guy, for starters, and he's been in and out of politics since 1965, when he was Yakutat mayor, replacing his dad. He's been Juneau mayor. He's the CEO of Sea Alaska Corporation. He's got a long resume. Executive director of the Permanent Fund, Juneau's mayor, AFN, Nature Conservancy. He's been on all sides of this thing. He understands how government works, and he understands how business works. I think he'll be very intelligent guy who will fight this thing more on an intellectual level than a fireworks and call press conference level. So,
Steve, are there going to be any other demos in this race?
I don't know. I really don't know. Again, we've said this many times on this program, that the Democrats in Alaska have a very, very short bench. The only one I think I could see off the top of my head, Bill Willikowski, the state senator.
Yeah, he sort of disappeared recently.
He really has. I mean, there was talk about him maybe being the lieutenant governor's, the running mate, so to speak, for Bill Walker, and that didn't pan out. Of course, Hollis French took that, jumped into the lieutenant governor's race this week as well. Bill Willikowski, whether you agree with him or not, you have to give it up, I think, and agree that he spoke very eloquently against House Bill 21, again, the income tax revision bill for the oil industry. He was clearly the loudest voice, and I think made a good case against that. Of course, the supporters for HB 21 won the day, and that's the law right now. But he may be somebody out there that could attract some attention, but whether he's a statewide name, I don't really know. So I think this may be it. I think it might be Byron Mallott, who's incredibly charismatic, too. It'll be interesting to hear him speak on the stump. And then you've got Bill Walker, and then you've got Sean Parnell. If that holds, now, here's some early prognostication. Go back to 1994. There was a three-way race.
Yeah,
Jack Coghill running for the Alaska Independence Party. Very conservative guy. Yeah, Jim Campbell running for the Republicans, and you had Tony Knowles representing the Democrats. Knowles beat Campbell by like one percentage point in that particular race, and I think Coghill got like 13% of the vote that he took away probably a lot from Campbell, and probably it's easy to say cost Campbell that race. So now you've got a three-way race right now where you're out easily. And it'd be interesting to see if Parnell and Walker do each other in, and that's an advantage for me.
And we do have some other candidates who've announced who are usually categorized as minor candidates, but we'll get to them as we go along. And a surprise, Paul Jenkins, Hollis French says he's running for LG, Lieutenant Governor.
I don't think it's really a surprise. I think he had planned to run for governor. He'd run for governor before.
Yeah, he
didn't want to have a contentious governor's Democratic primary kind of thing going on. So he decided he would step down into the lieutenant governor's, which is the great job. That's the best job.
And every one of these guys who runs for lieutenant governor announces they're going to be a new kind of lieutenant governor. Yeah.
And they're all my heroes. They're going for the best job on the planet.
And just make sure there's enough ballots, and that's okay.
Where's the seal? Okay, thanks.
Seal.
I'll be in Hawaii.
That's right.
I mean, that's what you do. Anyway, it's not a surprise, and these two will be a pretty formidable team, actually.
Yeah. And we should point out, too, that Alaskan voters elect both of these positions.
That's exactly
so you can't run as a ticket like in a presidential campaign.
No, in the primary.
In the primary, yeah, right. In the primary race. So, it's not a foregone conclusion that these guys will be a ticket, but it looks pretty good at this point on the Democratic side.
It's highly likely, yeah.
Highly likely.
Steve, back to the government shutdown. A couple days before the shutdown ended, Governor Parnell threatened to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service if it did not open refuges across Alaska. Why the threat of a lawsuit?
Because we always sue the federal government. That's what we do. They breathe, we sue them. It just seems to get that way, doesn't it? Actually, Governor Parnell was really upset the way the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service shut down the refuges. They just closed it off. Access denied for everybody except subsistence users. He felt that violated Department of the Interior protocol in shutting down the refuges. So he wanted them reopened. People, hunting and fishing guides who depend on refuges for their living, they were shut out of these places. So he was pretty angry with that. He was trying to protect them. And so he had filed, threatened a lawsuit, sent a letter to the head of the Department of Interior.
And then we had the resolution on Wednesday.
And the resolution, so we didn't have to sue anybody.
And a story that is a hardy perennial, the Metsu Borough is still attempting to sell that $78 million ferry that has never carried a paying passenger. Recently in Abu Dhabi, shipping company offered $2 million for the vessel, and the Metsu Borough turned them down. Paul, give us some more on this latest installment.
The problem is that the Metsu Borough government owes the federal government $6 million for this free vessel.
Oops.
That was
was
given to them as part of a deal put together by Ted Stevens. It's a Navy prototype, and it was supposed to haul tanks, that sort of thing. It's $80 million boat, $78 million. That's a couple million.
Yeah.
They got the boat, I think, in June. It's been sitting in dock ever since June 2012. It's been there ever since, down around Sitka, Ward Cove. It's now there. They voted now because it's costing them something like $70,000 a month. I'm sorry, $70,000 a month for this thing just to sit there, and they start it up once a month, I guess, and they take it out and drive it around in the ocean for a while and bring it back, and $70,000 a month for this thing that they're not using. And the reason they're not using it, of course, is when they got the ferry, there's no terminal on either end. They wanted to use it to haul cars back and forth between Port McKenzie and Anchorage. And there's nowhere for them to get off the boat on either end. So here we are. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to put up the money for that. They owe the $6 million. They don't know quite what to do. They have to pay that $6 million. If that boat is not used in Cook Inlet or by another government entity, nobody wants it. So that's where they are right now. And they're going to put it into a wet layup, they call a wet layup, which is park it at a dock and come out and turn on the lights once in a while, and that's pretty much it. That's supposed to drop it down to something less than $29,000 a month. Matsu taxpayers must be just ecstatic by that. That's a good thing for them.
Mm-hmm. I suspect so. Steve, after the expenditure of millions of dollars and the potential to expend more millions, what is the lesson to be learned here?
Here's the lesson. Before you build a boat, have your docks in a row.
All day
to say that. These guys got off and like you said, the feds built this ferry boat, but they had a $6 million grant, so they're on the hook, and now they're on the hook for the storage. They went off and did this without building a dock on the Anchorage side, without building a dock on the Port McKenzie side. They have no place to tie this ship off. They have no place to land passengers, cars, or tanks, should they decide to move them and attack the Anchorage area. I don't know. But they've got no place. Yeah, they have no place to put people. You should have had permission from Anchorage and an agreement with Anchorage as to where this thing was going to land. You should have had the dock built in the Matsu so you could operate this vessel. They just plowed ahead and had this ship built and the $6 million grant in hand. And nowhere to operate this. So maybe again, you should just plan these things out a lot better before you go off and actually christen the ship and start running around the ocean with it.
Steve, I'm quite proud of you. Somehow you managed not to call this a fairy tale.
A fairy tale.
The proposed Pebble Mine is back in the news, Paul. The Pebble Partnership, the mine proponents, and the state are demanding legal fees nearing $1 million associated with a lawsuit that environmental groups and others brought in 2010. The opponents lost. Let's start with Steve first on this kind. Paul, we'll just pass you for a second here. Explain to us what was the basis of the suit, and why did the judge use the term or Why did we hear around the courtroom the term public interest litigant so much?
The suit was brought by Bella Hammond, the wife of former governor and the late Jay Hammond, and Vic Fisher, who is a political legend here in Alaska. He's a former state senator, and he's one of the fathers of the state constitution. They brought the suit. They felt that the state was should have been holding public hearings, should have addressed the public, explained to the public what it was doing and what Pebble was going to do with this land. The judge basically ruled and said, well, this is a temporary agreement. This is something
Judge Arseth
says that in his ruling that yes, there was going to be work done by Pebble, but it wasn't anything that was going to be longstanding, or they weren't going to do irreparable harm in any way to the land. It could be cleaned up, and they could go away if they didn't get their permits, and the land would be as good as new if they failed to get their drilling permits and actually develop the land. Now, the public interest litigant used to be able to file lawsuits against projects this, which was commonplace for environmental groups, and you'd hold up the start of these projects. Years ago, when Frank Murkowski was governor, he had a bill passed that basically said, you can be a public interest litigant, but if you sue and you lose, you're on the hook for the legal fees. So Judge Arseth ruled in favor of Pebble, ruled in favor of the state. And now Bella Hammond and Vic Fisher and several other people who joined this lawsuit are on the hook for about $900,000 to $1 million.
And there may be potential other organizations that have contributed to it.
Very well could be. So now it's been appealed to the Supreme Court, and we'll see what they
do. I think they're going to hear it in December and then issue a ruling at some time after that.
Yeah.
What really are the court's alternatives, Paul?
Well, they're going to have the hearing on December 17th. This thing started off, like Steve pointed out, over temporary water permits, land use permits. The litigants claimed, the plaintiffs claimed that they were disposing of state land without public hearing. They didn't like that. Going through this whole public law where you get reimbursed, there are three things. There's one, you can be reimbursed if it's got a concern, a constitutional issue, which Judge Arseth said it did.
And that's going to be one of the points of appeal.
And it cannot be frivolous. And he said it was not frivolous. Mm-hmm. What's at issue is the plaintiffs also must have no economic interest. Pebble is claiming there is an economic interest, that this lawsuit's been funded in large part by outside environmental groups. It's been a very contentious lawsuit, with plaintiffs demanding every scrap of paper, I guess, that Pebble has. They've drawn in the ACLU now, the Alaska Conservation Foundation. It's huge, mm-hmm. and it's getting bigger all the time. So the Supreme Court has to decide, I guess, is there some financial interest in play here too before they decide? They could toss the whole thing out. They could rule in such a fashion that the trustees for Alaska could turn around and sue for reimbursement for their costs, and on and on. So it's a mess.
Okay, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News had several big stories on drunken driving in Anchorage. Kyle's stories appeared just recently. Among other things, Kyle Hopkins discussed potential approaches to reduce drunken driving and drunken driving deaths. Steve, what is to be done? Yeah. It's your day as philosopher king.
Yeah. Kyle's series, if you've missed it, you should go back online and
read excellent. It. It's excellent.
It's a very, very good series, and it really puts in perspective just the kind of problems that Alaska faces with excessive drinking. Some of the things that Kyle brought up in the article, the one article that he read about this, he said, you know, there was a proposal to have extra police downtown, all the bars empty at the same time. The closing time is whatever, and everybody comes out onto the street, so there are a lot of inebriated people on the downtown streets all at the same time. That costs a lot of money and overtime to have officers down there. Another proposal was to have random drug test, alcohol sobriety tests for drivers, and that's where you basically put up a roadblock on a street and you announce it ahead of time, and you pull
There's a constitutional way to do that, as has been explained.
And it works in other communities. I think Minneapolis has this, and it was explored back, I think, again, during the Knowles administration when he was the governor. I believe he explored this idea, and people came out and just said, no, this is wrong. You don't do that. It got the same reception photo radar did when the city of Anchorage instituted photo radar. So that idea dropped. So these are, you know, just some of the ideas. Of course, one of the things that the Anchorage Police Department did, and this is basically a pioneer program. We'll see how this works, and that is getting citizens to volunteer and look for signs of drunken drivers.
So far, there seems to be some potential for that.
There's been a few people these citizens who volunteer hours and hours on a weekend.
Let's get Paul in here for less than a minute. Paul, the worst offenders have records, repeated violations, and general indifference to the law. What's the response to them?
I don't know. I don't know. How do you respond to that? How do you respond to someone who doesn't care what the law says, who's so addicted that the law means nothing to them? I would think that
one of the things you can try to do is keep them out of automobiles, right?
Well, and that's what I was going to go to. The longer and stiffer the sentence, the fewer offenders. Other countries put them in jail for long stretches.
Yeah.
I think that's what it takes.
I think that's
what it takes. The only way to ensure they can't offend is put them in a position where they can offend.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible thing to say, but
well, some of these
that's
people,
where we are.
Yeah, some of these people have gotten drunk, gotten behind the wheel, and killed somebody. And at first they're maybe charged with second-degree homicide, and then they plea bargain later on to a lower offense. Maybe you don't plea bargain.
Maybe you don't.
Our plea is that we're out of here. Thank you so much for joining us on Alaska Edition. We'll see you right here next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.